So yesterday, Paul talked about these threads aligned with the magnetic field at Taurus, and I just wanted to point out that those aren't unique. My very first published paper was a map of a very strong self-absorption feature in the general direction of the galactic center. It's a huge feature extending over some 40 degrees in the plane and plus or minus 10 degrees, and it's mapped, as I said, in self-absorption. Yeah. And it's about 125 parsecs away. I think it's likely, by the way, that the Rho molecular cloud is actually part of this complex, because as you go from its longitude up, the self-absorption gradually goes away and then comes back as a narrow feature at about the same velocity as Rho, and Rho is at this distance. This is a study with the Parkes and the Australia Compact Array of a 5x5 degree part of this cloud. And as you can see, this is mapped in H1 self-absorption. You can see these long, narrow filaments, 17 parsecs by unresolved. And although they didn't superimpose polarization data, the starlight polarization is aligned with these things. And so they say that if these filaments are magnetically dominated, it requires a magnetic field strength of greater than about 30 microgauss. There's one relevant measurement. The very distant W22H2 region is just off of this particular map right there, but it's where this same cloud exists. And many years ago, we measured the magnetic field in the OH-Zeeman effect and got 18 microgauss, and since that's only the line of sight component, it's perfectly consistent with a very strong magnetic field in this region.
This is also H1.
No, this is OH.
OH.
What does that region look like in molecular gas?
Well, there's not a lot of work that's been done.
Following your suggestion, I read that paper that their claim of McClure-Griffith et al. Is that those filaments have a column density of about 10 to the 20th. Oh.
Yep.
It's not going to, not such a great.
But there are other parts of that cloud, though, where the column density in H1 is larger, and you get, in some places, CO, which is at exactly the right velocity and width for being associated with this thing.
I guess no one has a, I mean, if you go back to that, I mean, this was, an angular resolution of about one arc
right.
minute or something. So in principle, there are. This is, although this is a cloud only 125 parsecs away, you're looking right at the galactic center, so I'm sure it's covered in the Bell Labs.
Yeah, sure. One should be able to get that information out of those data. I agree. They, by the way, by modeling these things as cylinders with these kind of dimensions, get a density of a few hundred for these kind of objects. Okay, but what I mainly wanted to talk about is Zeeman's survey. And I've collected here some data sets that I'm going to use. There are other Zeeman data, but in general, they're not in this thing either because I haven't had time yet or because they lack volume density, or that's supposed to be a capital N, column density or radius information. So Hylas and Trolland have studied the H1 Zeeman effect by studies of the line and absorption against quasars. Very early, we did a Greenbank 140-foot OH dark cloud survey. Trolland and I have just finished and are about to submit a much more extensive Arecibo survey of dark cloud cores. There, in cases where the Zeeman effect has been detected otherwise, some BLA mapping has taken place. There are CN Zeeman observations with ERAM, two earlier papers, and then Valgaron and Trolland and I will submit a new paper very soon. And then Gustin at Bonn detected the Zeeman effect in absorption in a very excited rotational state of OH, looking at the lambda doublet transition. So out of these, what I'll call surveys, there's 54 detections out of 148 positions. One thing to absolutely keep in mind is that the Zeeman effect is only sensitive to the line of sight component of the magnetic field. So that's a very severe limitation and requires a statistical analysis, which I'm now going to talk about. But first, this is all of those data from all that survey work plotted. So it's line of sight magnetic field plotted against volume density with error bars. And everything is there, so non-detections are there as well. Here's a non-detection because the error bar goes all the way down to essentially zero. One thing, and by the way, I'm not going to use this single point right here, that Sagittarius B2, which is a unique molecular cloud. It's the most massive in the galaxy and obviously doesn't fit this.
How do you derive the density?
Pardon?
How do you derive the density?
A variety of different ways. I can go into that in detail later, but it'll take me a while to do it. One thing one could do is just take this upper envelope, and if you do that, you find that it's consistent at low densities with a constant magnetic field, and then something like a dependence is a square root of density. If you use that kind of a number, though, you're assuming that the magnetic field strength, the total magnetic field strength at every density is the same, and that the reason some of these points are down here is projection. And that's not necessarily the correct thing to do. It may be that you have some positions where the total magnetic field strength is very, very small, and it lies down there not necessarily because of projection, because the field strength is really small. So how can you address that? First, here's an example of what super alphanic simulations might produce. This is a alphanic Mach number 2, so it's not very super alphanic, one that Lazarian gave me, this data cube, and so I plotted it up this way. And in this case, you get some very small magnetic fields and some very large, few very large magnetic fields.
Like number of pixels or something like that.
Number of voxels. Yeah, so it's basically a probability density function. So that's what we need to talk about. These are possible probability density functions for the total magnetic field strength. One is to assume that the magnetic field strength is the same and that the only reason you see differences are projection effects. Another possible extreme is to assume it's flat, that it goes from zero total magnetic field strength to some number and then cuts off, and the median value is the same here, so that's why this goes out to 2. And here's some other possible ones. This looks more or less more like the simulations and so forth. But from these kind of probability density functions for B total, you can calculate the probability density function for what you observe, namely the line of sight. So that delta function one, you would expect to see up to the total field strength all the way down to zero with a flat distribution. The flat one, which is one of these right here, you'll see a large number of very small fields and some very large fields and so forth. The median in all cases is pretty close to half of the median of the total. Okay, so what we can do is take these data and apply that kind of analysis to try to figure out if we can determine what the intrinsic probability density function for the total magnetic field strengths is. And it's pretty clear that there's two distinct regimes. This regime where there's no dependence on volume density, and a regime where there seems to be a dependence on volume density. The way we did this is I recruited a colleague at Illinois, Ben Van Delt, who's a cosmologist, who has developed, he's a member of the Planck team, and has developed some powerful analysis techniques based on Bayesian probability analysis. And so he agreed to work with me to apply that kind of analysis to these data. So we first looked at the H1 data and considered two probability PDFs. One, that the magnetic field strength was unique, that is the delta function. Every single field intrinsically is the same, and the reason there's a variation is just projection. And the other, that flat one, where the field varies from some upper limit intrinsically uniformly down to zero. And when you do the Bayesian analysis, you find you can't distinguish between those two. The ratio of the probabilities is 1 to 1.5. This shows the distribution function for the unique case. The median value is 6 micrograus, which is the same as Hylas and Trolin got in their analysis, although they didn't use quite so sophisticated an analysis.
So this you expected already from the previous plot. So it's just like testing
Well, you expect it or not, but it's what...
Well, because you saw that the delta function gave a flat uniform distribution. The uniform distribution presumably stays uniform, so you would expect that you couldn't distinguish between the two, right?
No, I don't think that's true, because I'm about to say that you can distinguish between the two in the molecular case. It depends on how these points are distributed, basically. If all of the values here are the same intrinsically, then you can predict what the scatter up and down is.
Well,
on the other hand,
because that is uniform, yes.
Yeah. On the other hand, if you okay, so that's the result for the H1. Here's the result for the OH and CN. What was done was to assume that the median value for the magnetic field is some number scaled as density to the 1/2. What went into this was all the observations. There's no distinguishing between so-called detections and non-detections. A non-detection constrains the line of sight magnetic field to some value between zero and some number. Also used as a so-called prior was an uncertainty of a factor of 2 in the volume densities. And the result is this number right here. So for example, at a density of 100, this would give a median magnetic field strength of 6.4 microgauss, which matches up pretty well with there. The density of 10 to the 6, you get 640 microgauss.
What is the
substrate? Means it's the median value. And this is the obviously you can see there's a significant uncertainty in that from about, you know, a bit of 0.4 to 0.8.
So the equipartition model is out of the window.
But what this says then is that the uniform model, that is, magnetic field strengths varying from some upper limit all the way down to zero, is vastly preferred over the unique model. Vastly preferred.
What's the intensity you have there?
I'm sorry?
What's the advanced speed you have in that model?
I can't understand you.
What's the advanced speed you have in that model?
Oh, there's no. You can infer the Alphane speed from these data, but there's nothing that's been put in. You can do that. You can do the same kind of analysis with these numerical probability density functions you'd get from simulations, but we haven't actually done that yet. Okay. So what? This, by the way, is then those same data with a median total magnetic field strength now plotted there. And in this case, it's 6. It could be that every single one of these points has a total field strength of 6 microgauss, or more or less equally probable that they range between 12 all the way down to 0 as the intrinsic total field strength. Out in the molecular regime, it again strongly prefers the intrinsic or total field strength being distributed between some small number and a number which is twice this median. So it says that the field strengths vary between a number factor of 2 above this line, in principle all the way down to 0.
So it's limited by equipartition, just like Powell told us.
I'm sorry? Oh, it's certainly, the numbers that would, you can't tell for any one object whether the field is small or large, but clearly it certainly can't be an equipartition because some of them have to be very small.
Right, but it's still true that the upper limit, just like he said, what is equipartition? No, it's the upper end.
Yeah, right, yeah. Okay, so I can, and this, by the way, Ralph gave me a preprint of a paper on which he based a talk a week or so ago. And I just picked this one out of his paper. It's a simulation starting off with a supercritical by a factor of 16. And this then shows the resulting mass to flux ratios. These are bound and these are unbound. And you can see, even though you start off supercritical by a factor of 16, these bound cores go from subcritical by maybe a factor of 2 to supercritical by a factor of about 10. That is perfectly consistent with the analysis of the data that I just described. And other simulations, as I understand it, give similar kind of results. A few of them subcritical, and certainly those near the boundary of that curve I showed you a moment ago would be subcritical by a factor of order 2, but many of them would be supercritical.
But the upper bound judging from the crosses, those where you actually have measurements, right?
I'm sorry?
Most of the actual measurements with low error bars are at the upper bound.
Yeah. Right. That?
No?
Right, sure.
They are
that would be where you actually can measure it because the field line of sight field is strong. But these that are only that they're not detected, again, could have a weak intrinsic field or weak total field, or they could that could be a projection effect. But all of these data are treated equally in this Bayesian probability analysis. There's no distinguishing. I mean, a number, a measurement like that constrains the field to be between zero and some number like that. This constrains the field over that range. And all of that is a prior which is put into the analysis. So there's no ignoring any of the non-detections. They're treating them differently from the detections themselves. So here's the result for, I divided things into H1, OH, and CN clouds because you can see the data kind of divide that way. These are the H1 clouds, more or less the OH clouds and the CN clouds. And from the median magnetic field strength, which I just talked about, at the median volume densities, you get these kind of numbers. And then you can calculate the median value for these kind of things. So the median value, say, in the OH clouds is slightly superalphanic and approximately critical. So some of those clouds will be slightly subcritical because the median, I mean, the maximum field will be about twice this median. And some of them will be highly supercritical. And similarly over here.
Dick, can you associate an uncertainty with median value?
Yes. That's what these kind of plots do. So this is the probability. So at a sort of a half probability, it goes between maybe 0.5 and 0.7, or maybe a little more in that number right there. So if you fold that into the calculation of things like Alphane speed and mass to flux ratio, you can calculate an uncertainty. Again, in the median values, you can't do it for any one object because of the projection effects.
And similarly for the six microgauss, that's like four to eight or
I think the formal number is about one. So five to seven.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So here's a kind of a summary. Two different models and comparing with observations. So densities in the tens, the hundreds, and the thousands plus. Observed, these H1 clouds are highly subcritical. And by the time you get up to the molecular clouds, some are slightly subcritical, but most are critical to, in some cases, they'd be highly supercritical. We don't really know observationally what goes on in this intermediate region. This is this sort of inter-core region that Phil was talking about. However, I think we can approach what's going on here because these threads in the H1 self-absorption are densities of order a few hundred. And a more careful study of magnetic fields in those kind of regions and in the regions between cores and, say, GMCs, it will be possible to do this. We currently have a big project underway at the GBT to do exactly that. In any case, the ambipolar diffusion model calls for a progression from subcritical to slightly subcritical to critical to slightly supercritical. The turbulent superalphanic turbulent simulations start off highly supercritical and then more or less progress to a situation, as I showed you before, ranging from supercritical to slightly subcritical. So one kind of strange thing, perhaps, is there seem to be some discrepancies here. That is, these guys are measured to be highly subcritical, and yet this starts off highly supercritical. It's likely, if you take that filamentary structure you see in H1 self-absorption and the magnetic field strength of order 30 microgauss, that would be subcritical.
Where do you get the anti-supercritical for the simulation on the low
this? Density? Well, that's just because that's where you start off. In the simulations, you start off with supercritical values.
Our own simulations are set for clump conditions, so it would be starting as a piece of GMC.
Mm-hmm.
So
higher than that.
Yes. Not okay. The H1, although you, of course, raise a superb point.
But I think the bottom line is that at high densities, the data are much more consistent with this picture than they are with that picture.
But you shouldn't call it turbulent simulation. You should call it supraorganic simulation. Because non-supraorganic simulation would not give that result.
Right.
It would give
the
result for a diffusion.
Okay. I think work in this regime right here is what's going to be most important, both from the observational front to try to discern what the magnetic field strengths are at densities of a few hundred. And in the simulation front, it's going to be very interesting to see if these kind of threads are a common structure, observationally, whether they're a common structure at densities of a few hundred, and whether the simulations can produce that kind of thing. It's going to be hard for the simulations because it requires very high resolution.
Simulation
because they're very
H1,
thin.
No.
H1 and Paul has seen it in CO. So, but presumably densities of order 100 to a few hundred is the relevant density range. Now, you see these kind of threads in other areas. For example, ROF itself has these kind of streamers which go off to the east. The magnetic field is aligned along those streamers, more or less. S106 is another example where you have a core with molecular streamers going off again to the east, and the magnetic field is aligned with those streamers. And at lower densities, the magnetic field seems to be aligned with the streamers. So whether that is not a common observational thing or not, I don't know. But
okay, I think I got to be fair. In other words, the stuff that Paul was showing yesterday is perfectly aligned with the polarization spectrum. And the stuff that you show, I'm going to believe that it is, even though you can show us the polarization spectrum. But ROF, I don't know enough about S106, but ROF, you know, it's like 20, 30 degrees within the filament. And in projection, you know, you can get that very easily from a lot of orientations.
Okay.
So I actually think that there's something significant about the fact that you only see this in the much lower density, skinnier things.
Yeah.
This is great.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the current status of at least observations of magnetic fields, and in trying to distinguish between different models for star formation based on how strong magnetic fields are in these kind of regimes. Should I call on people?
You ended at 12. It's their fault that they keep asking.
Okay.
Would you comment on whether you put much credence on measurements of the magnetic field based on the Chandrasekhar Fermi analysis, and how, if so, to what extent does it fit in with the picture you're developing?
Well, I mean, I think the only direct information is three groups have done simulations and calculated Chandrasekhar Fermi estimates of magnetic fields, knowing what they are from the simulations. And at higher densities where the dispersion and position angles are small, you seem to get the correct answer to within a order of factor of 2. If the dispersions are very large, you usually highly overestimate the strength of the field. Now, one thing we're trying to do is observe with the Zeeman effect exactly the same objects where this Chandrasekhar Fermi method has been applied. And then if you can do that for a number of them, you can have build up a statistical database where you can test that. But it's hard to do because you need a tracer which traces the same material as the dust. But actually, we have observing time at CSO in December to try to do this toward one object. But I think, I don't know, I didn't actually consider the Chandrasekhar Fermi measurements in this kind of analysis, although one could do that, but they seem to give compatible magnetic field strengths within a order of factor of 2 to what you get from the Zeeman effect, and you can include that in this Bayesian analysis by just putting a suitable uncertainty, factor of 2 or 3 or whatever you like, as a prior in the Bayesian analysis.
I mean, I just kind of, because I know there's quite a lot of effort going into building polarimeters, thus polarization measurements, and that's one of the few concrete outcomes that will ever come out of those measurements.
Yeah. Well, I think it may be possible to calibrate it observationally, aside from the simulation calibrations, by getting enough observations of the Zeeman effect, which is line of sight, and the Chandrasekhar Fermi method, which is more the plane of the sky. If you get enough objects, you can see how well the two agree statistically.
I think that from the Stryker simulation where they calibrate the Chandrasekhar Fermi, as far as I remember, you have an upper limit on the dispersion angle. In other words, the Chandrasekhar Fermi works only if the seems to work only if the field is strong enough.
Yeah, if the dispersion of the position angles, I think they said less than 25 degrees, which means the field is relatively strong, then it seems to work. And if the dispersion is large, then you tend to overestimate the field strength.
What's interesting, though, is that in this regime where you have a question mark, that's exactly where the polarimetry is likely to still be meaningful and have a dispersion less than.
Yeah. This regime, by the way, can be well explored with OH, I think. Because it samples those kind of densities very well. That's what we're trying to do at Green Bank, is sample the sort of the regions away from the cores, the envelopes of the cores. Yes?
In your plot of the field strength versus log-log plot, and field strength versus density, you have this beautiful square of band dependence. And I just wanted to probe you a little on that. If it really is that way, that implies, I think, as someone who was asking, a unique value for the alpine speed.
Might be around 1 kilometer per second.
Yes, over many orders of magnitude, and I wonder if that is realistic.
That's the upper end of bone, dude.
Well, actually, something else in principle which one could do is leave that exponent as a free parameter in the Bayesian analysis. My own opinion is that there's not going to really be enough data to define all of these various possible parameters.
Okay.
I don't know what's going on with that, but we are going to try that and see if we can try to constrain that. The half is just picked by taking that upper envelope and saying that's what looked reasonable in the first version of this analysis.
The other question is the field strength that you derive from the Zeeman effect depends on the resolution of the beam that you're using, or can depend.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to ask whether there is now enough data to answer the question if I have a large beam and I measure a certain value with a low field strength, and then I come back and make a higher resolution observation of the same region, and I attribute a new density to the smaller structure that I'm now sensitive to, does the new value of the field strength slide up along the b goes like n to the 1/2 line?
I don't think, not directly. For example, in NGC 2024, with a single dish and absorption, you measure a Zeeman effect. We've mapped that with the VLA. And the field goes from, there's a kind of a north-south going filament that you're looking at. The field goes from zero line of sight on one side to roughly twice the single dish value on the other side of that filament. So there's maybe that's a projection effect. But there's what you usually find is right in the middle where the density is highest is where the field is sort of the median value. So it's kind of hard to answer that question because you're always concerned with projection effect issues. But in a few cases in dark cloud cores where we have OH Zeeman detections, and B1 is one example where we also looked at it with the 140 foot, which had a six times bigger beam, the magnetic field dropped by I think about a factor of a third, and if you look at the column densities involved, they also dropped by about that factor. I think a little bit different from that, but this project that's underway at Green Bank, by the way, is we've taken the six placed Arecibo cores where we have the strongest detections, and we're putting a Green Bank beam down around like this to try to measure the field in the surrounding envelope, and one will therefore be able to try to see whether there's a change in the differential mass to flux ratio from the envelope to the core.
Bill just wants you to add one more Green Bank beam right on top of
his comparison. But I mean, there's very little excluded by that. This is less than 3 arc minutes, and these are about 8 arc minutes. But one could do that. But
the worry is that you know if you were to observe all the same objects again,
mm-hmm.
with much better resolution and sensitivity, if you could,
mm-hmm.
would you get the same answer?
I don't think you'd get exactly the same answer because, if you mapped it with higher resolution, the mean would be the same as you'd observe with the larger beam, I think. But you'll see variations in the field across this area if you map it with higher angular resolution. And so then what you could do is take, the column density at each of the resolution elements and do the same kind of a plot. In cases where this has been done with the VLA, for example, there's only six good cases like that. It seems to work pretty well. That is, the variations in column density and field strength seem to correlate in most cases, although Orion B is an outstanding example where it doesn't, where it must be, I think, due to structure in the field.
This is great. Thank you. Thanks again. I just went to check with the person who was checking where we're having dinner, and the sign on her door that said she'd be in at 12 now says she's out for the day. So I will find out on my own. But the place where I think we're having dinner is this beach, or where you're welcome to come have dinner, is this Beachside Cafe, which is down the beach. You can walk to it, or you can drive.
Are you going to reserve?
But I will, but I have to find out. There was this, the issue was that there was this shrimp special that was like $9.99 for a skewer of shrimp dinner, and otherwise the place is a little bit expensive, and so we were trying not to go there if they didn't have the special dinner. We'll try. Anyway, I will send out email this afternoon on whatever the destination is, but don't go.
Are there enough cars if we decided to go somewhere else?
Probably. So, anyway, and then the last thing is, in this sort of what questions would you have future thing, Phil's in charge. So that'll be tomorrow's wrap up. And so you can talk to Phil, email Phil.
Please tell him and share your thoughts.
Yes. And so that's the last thing we'll do tomorrow, is we'll have that discussion. And
It needs 1 week to prepare.
Are you kidding? So great. So let's have lunch, and those of you who want the demo, 12:30.